This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll take a walk down memory lane with a Cape Breton woman who recently celebrated her 108th birthday. Also, we'll chat with a proud Cape Breton mom about her Grammy Award-winning son and his Juno nomination. Still on the music scene, tune in to find out how to get tickets as the Cape Breton Chorale prepares a special homecoming for a Glace Bay native, and our newsroom has a conversation with the provincial NDP leader ahead of the spring sitting of the legislature. These stories are coming up on the Coast.
Got excited, then he shouted to them there, it's a long way to Tipperary.
In 1915, about 6 months after the start of the First World War, when Sir Robert Borden was Prime Minister, when Albert Einstein was in his prime at 36 years old, Pablo Picasso was a young man at 30. Before the start of the Great Depression, NHL, and Walt Disney Company, the song It's a Long Way to Tipperary was a Billboard hit. But more importantly, in 1915, it's when Margaret McPhee of Bedeck was born on a small farm. She recently celebrated her 108th birthday.
Well, I was born on a farm at Upper Bedeck River on a stormy night. I don't know how we ever lived through it all, but anyway, farming wasn't a very easy chore in those years. And I went to the country school, of course, a mile and a half away. And on some days in the winter time, sometimes we had to go on snowshoes to get through. And maybe as the day went by, it would get stormy, and our father used to come to meet us with the horse and sleigh and take the whole school home. I remember those days, all right. And we played at school. We went out at noon and we played Stormy Weather. That's what's the name of our game. There would be one like a captain, he'd call or she would call Stormy Weather, and the rest of the kids would all come running and he'd try to see how many he or she could tap with their hand. In the spring and in the hall, we played ball outside. In the house, we just played with one another, I guess. I didn't even have a doll when I was growing up. And I don't know how we managed when we were, there was 11 of us in the family. In those years, there wasn't even a telephone. And if you had to get a doctor, you had to go into Bedeck to get the doctor and take him out and send him home again. So it was a hard life. We never had a television in my day until I was half as old as I am today. And when I left home, I went to Hunter's Mountain to work. There's where I went, left home to go to work first, over to Hunter's Mountain. And from there, I went from home to home work. And there was an old lady in every, I thought she was old, maybe she wasn't as old as I thought. There was an old lady in every home I went to work in. So that was the beginning of my working days, from home to home like that.
Margaret, did you ever leave Cape Breton? Did you ever work and live elsewhere?
Yes, I went to the States for a year and a half or so, to Washington, but I didn't like it there. I wouldn't want to be living there. I went with some of those Americans, the Bavaria Bells. They were looking for girls that would go back with them to work, so it was a good opportunity for me, I thought. So myself and a friend of mine went with them, and I didn't stay long. I didn't care for the state, so I came home and settled down in my own life.
You know, Margaret, going over 108 years, you've certainly seen a lot of things change with new inventions and different ways of life. When you look back, can you think of, maybe your favorite moments in history, whether it be an invention or some landmarks? What was remarkable to you during the course of 108 years?
Well, there was electricity was one change, and telephone was another change, and
television,
and radio, all those things. And I suppose there are others, but I don't remember them.
All these life experiences that you did have, Margaret, and I'm sure so many great moments in your life. Is there a story that you might be able to share with us? Something that maybe you remember from your childhood that you could tell us?
Well, one that I suppose you are getting tired hearing already is when I was a little child creeping along the floor. My father was used to... My father used to work in the lumber woods or in the fire, getting firewood. And he wasn't home at that day. And my mother used to look after the animals at noon. We all had animals. And at noon, she used to go and let them out to drink and feed them and all that. So this day, that happened. And I had an older brother, two older brothers. And my mother left them in looking after me while she was out doing the animals. So she happened to come to the stable door and she saw this big smoke coming out of the flue and could smell it. So she ran in to see what was going on. And I was just toddling on the floor. And we had a chimney behind the stove, and we all just threw everything there, the bark off the wood and old papers and kindling and things like that. And it was an open fireplace. And she looked, and here the chimney was going on fire, and I was right up at the chimney, and my older brother had taken the other boy into a bedroom and closed the door.
Oh, thanks so much for sharing that, Margaret. That's quite a story, and what a memory that you have. I have to ask you, what is the secret to your success to enjoy? How does one go about enjoying such a long and happy, healthy life, such as you are doing?
Oh, well, if I'll tell it, it won't be a secret. I can't see what I say, Lord. To be happy and not to be getting into any trouble or causing trouble to themselves or their families or to other people, and just to take it a day at a time, I guess.
Margaret, I can't tell you what a great pleasure this was to speak with you and for you to share your wisdom with us. Happy belated birthday, and I hope you have many, many more.
Oh, thank you, thank you. Many, many more. I think everyone I did, but that can't be many more, I don't think. Anyway, you're very welcome, and thanks for the interview.
Graham McKenzie is a pharmacist and owner of Stone's Pharmacy in Bedeque. He and the staff have become close friends with Margaret. Graham talks about his relationship with her, how they met, and his admiration for her sharp mind and sense of humor.
Yeah, so I've been here for 30 years. I came here in 93 after I graduated from Dow. And, well, of course, Margaret was here then. And she was always somebody that, you know, seemed like one of our oldest customers, but really had no issue getting around. And up until very lately, she was still coming into the pharmacy. She's would always look for something that would be maybe easier on her than, a prescription pain relief thing for her arthritis, because she really doesn't have a whole lot of medical issues to speak of. And, I'd give her a few things out front, and she'd claim that she was a new lady. And it's very, very, if all the customers were like Margaret, we'd have a maid. Like, she's just friendly and goes along with, what you suggest for her. And she's just a good person overall.
Graham, I think it might be important to mention how quickly the turnaround was for this interview to happen and the willingness for Margaret to take part in this. It was, like I said, really quite an honor for us. But can you talk about that, please? I find that very impressive that in less than an hour, we were able to make this interview happen.
Yeah, not a whole lot. I mean, Bedeque is a pretty tight community, and Brett is usually my contact to get in touch with Margaret through either a family member or directly to her herself. And we've come to her house many times, giving her vaccines. And we've come here for her birthdays in the past. And so what happened was, when you contacted me, I just let Beth know. And she had us all set up to go in about 10 minutes. And Margaret was pretty... Margaret, she doesn't have a whole lot on her docket every day. So She's always open to visitors, and she knows us, and she was comfortable with us coming out here, so we were happy to help.
So Margaret is spending a lot of time at home. Does she get the chance to get out every now and then?
She doesn't get out of her home a whole lot, especially in the wintertime. She's, if somebody wants to see Margaret, they come here. In the summertime, it's less and less that we see Margaret out. And I think at that age that kind of helps. She gets mobility around her house, but she's mindful of not falling or anything like that. So she I think she limits her time outside the house, but definitely she's no stranger to being outside.
So you've gotten to know Margaret pretty well, Graham. What is it that Margaret does differently than a lot of people to enjoy 108th birthday?
Well, I think one thing that really helps extend your life is if you have an extended network of friends and family and people that you can connect with. And I think that's been shown for people that have cancer and survival with different types of terminal diseases. The better your extended network, then the better your outcome with your longevity. And, of course, everybody in Bedeque knows Margaret, and she has a lot of people checking in on her. And I think that's probably a part of what it is. Like, she really, honestly, has no idea, I don't think, really what brought her here this long. But that has to be part of it, I think. Genetics definitely would have something to do with it. And she treated herself fairly well during her life. She wasn't hard on herself. But she mentioned to you about how hard she worked growing up, and I certainly think that put her on the path to a healthy life.
All righty, Graham, that's all the questions I had for you. Is there anything you'd like to add? Anything you think our listeners would like to know about Margaret?
No, I think she got the best laugh she had was when you wished her many more birthdays, so she really found that funny. She's got a good sense of humor.
Oh, indeed she does, Graham. That was such a treat to speak with her, and I'll never forget that. Thanks so much for your time, and hope to speak soon.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime, Bill.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary.
Gordy Sampson's up for another Juno nomination. The musician and songwriter won a Juno and Grammy Award for the Carrie Underwood hit 16 years ago, Jesus Take the Wheel. Sampson is notoriously humble about his work, his awards, and working relationships with some of the most popular artists out there. But Bill Bradley caught up with his mother, Flo Sampson. We'll hear about his roots in music and that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree.
Juno Awards are coming up on March 13th, and one of her own, Gordy Sampson, is nominated again for Juno. Now, back in 2007, you probably remember that Gordy was nominated for Juno for Jesus Take the Wheel. Not only did he win a Juno, but also won a Grammy that year as well. Thought it'd be interesting to talk to Gordy's mom, Flo Sampson. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much.
Now, Flo, before we even start talking about your son, of course, you've been performing for a number of years. How long have you been playing piano?
I've been playing publicly for 64 years of my life. I began with my father, who was Bernie Lee, and his twin fiddler, Joe McDougall. And our first dance was in Grand Anse, Cape Breton, and I was 11 and a half at the time, and I've been on stage ever since.
Of course, your dad, very popular back in his day, and musical
very
history
popular,
there, yeah.
Playing 6 and 7 nights a week.
So you started because of him, or how did that come about?
I did. He taught me how to chord to the fiddlers, and then my next job was to be in charge of the round dance part of the music. So he would buy me music sheets from the music store, and he'd listen to the radio and ask me to play the songs that were compatible to dance music. And so I took it from there, and we ended up leaving a 7-piece band to going down to a 3-piece band and still being very, very busy.
And your son Gordy started out as a young age as well. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, Gordy started at a very young age showing an active interest in music. So I just knew it was going to develop into something really big. And, you know, we didn't have a lot growing up, but what we had, we gave him to put him where he is today. So God bless him.
So when did Gordy start picking up the musical kind of interest?
Gordy was very young when I would be playing the piano down the living room. Little did I know, when he was supposed to be upstairs in his bedroom doing his homework, he was actually listening to what I was learning. And a number of times he'd run down over the stairs and say, okay, what was that one now? I'd like to know what that one is. And he'd have his guitar up in his room, and he'd be learning from the offshoot of what I was doing. So he started very, very young, and then he dropped the guitar for a little while, and he went to piano, and he had an active interest in that when he was around 14 years old, and took to the guitar again. That's when he started with a band in Halifax called Ricochet, and from Ricochet came back to Cape Breton and joined the band Real World, and from there it's history.
But wasn't there a band in between that? It was a Green Eggs and Jam, well, I think it was called?
Green Eggs and Jam he played with for a while with, yes, Carlo and Angelo Spinzola.
I remember playing that song, Angelina, and I think memory,
yes.
He sang that song, right?
Yes.
That's going back a number of years. So
it is, for sure.
So he performed like most Cape Breton artists around the island. Of course, the Real World was huge for him
with a bunch of the
Falls Boys from the North Side, and then moved on to his own career. So how did he make the step from actually singing and performing to songwriting and moving to Nashville? Tell us that process.
Well, I don't really understand myself how it began. I do know that after he left home, we found some things in his room, songs that he was trying to write. And at that point, he was very young, so we didn't know that that's where the final, you know, trip was going to be. And when he announced Nashville, I said to my husband, "Why Nashville?" And he said, "Oh, he found a better way to laugh to the bank." That was his answer. So.
Well, it's working for him. So
it sure is.
So he's finally in Nashville. So, okay, you go from Cape, because it's a long way from Cape Breton to Nashville. And then how do you get noticed in a place like Nashville? Because there's so many budding musicians and songwriters trying to get noticed. How did he do it?
I was always told from day one that Nashville guitar players were a dime a dozen, so that's why, again, he went into the field of songwriting. And I remember about 10 years ago meeting a man from Nashville at ECMA's in Newfoundland, and he said, "I'm going to tell you something that your son will never tell you." But he said, "He is among the top 10 songwriters in Nashville as we speak." So Gordy moved along pretty quickly.
So did he always have a knack for songwriting, or just kind of picked it up?
Oh, he did. No, he always had a knack for it. Like I said, I found some stuff in his room that he probably started when he was 12 years old.
Well, that must have been a proud moment when he won the Grammy and, of course, the Juno for Jesus Take the Wheel.
So exciting, Bill. So exciting. You know, it was just a dream come true for all of us.
Yeah, it's just amazing. First of all, to hear a Cape Bretoner win a Grammy, that's unheard of. But winning
that. He was the only Canadian Grammy winner that year. Yeah.
That in itself, just to be, you know, acknowledged as a Canadian, but then a Cape Bretoner winning a Grammy Award, and that launched his career into superstardom, I'm sure, for writing music.
Yes, for sure. Yes. Yeah. No, he's doing quite well, and we're very, very proud of him.
Also looking at some stuff online and social media, he's worked with many artists, but one that stands out is Keith Urban. And I remember seeing a picture online that he and Keith sharing a sandwich together, so they must have a pretty good relationship.
They do, actually. And when Keith married Nicole Kidman, Gordy was invited to the wedding, and Keith actually picked up little Amelie and started swinging her around the room. And there was lots of questions on social media. Who was the little girl that he was swinging around? And it was my granddaughter. So
Amelie's nominated again coming up on March 13th, Tennille Towns' The Last Time, which was co-written by Benjamin Goldsmith and himself. And I find it funny how that has his name. Instead of Gordy, it's got Gordon Samson.
Yes.
Does he like being called Gordon?
When he was born, but it didn't last very long.
So, does he like being called Gordon, or he just goes by Gordy?
He goes by Gordy, yes. Yeah.
So, but he'll answer to both, just to just make sure that it's written right on the check.
That's right.
So, not just Gordy, of course, in the family, but your sister's son, Keith Mullins, is also great in his own right.
Well. Yeah. Keith is doing awesome. We're very proud of him as well, yes.
For one point, and I remember talking to your sister many times, Debbie, Gordy and Keith hung out quite a bit. And actually, at one point, that Gordy was living in Debbie's basement, I hear.
That's right, in the apartment in the basement. That's right, for a while.
And they're probably jamming. And
we still do that today. We jam as often as we possibly can when he's home. So it's a great thing.
So the next question that I have is, are you going to the Juno Awards with Gordy this year, or are you going to sit back and watch it at home?
I doubt that Gordy will be going, to be honest with you. I haven't talked to him yet. Amy was on the phone with him the other night, but I'm not so sure that he will go himself, you know. And like, Gordy's so humble. He said to Amy, he said, "Look, don't be making a big deal of this, because it's not my award. It's going to Tennille Towns. I'll just get a replica."
Wow.
So, you know, he's a very, very humble boy. So he doesn't talk about his work. Or I remember being at the school at at Member 2 one day in the music room, and I got on the computer and I just looked up Gordy Samson on Wikipedia. I almost fell off the chair. The people he's written with and stuff. So he doesn't talk about his music. So we have a hard time following it.
The next question is, of course, you hear about Gordy coming home every now and then. So is he kind of one of these guys that keeps to himself kind of thing?
He has certain people that he likes to hang out with, and he loves to go boating in summer. So he really learns how to, you know, relax and let his hair down for just a little while. So he'll be here probably around, I want to say, May, and then he'll be going back to Nashville by August. Because Amelie's in college now, so they have to be back for her, right?
You would say he probably spends 90% of his time in Nashville and the other 10% here in Cape Breton Island?
Absolutely, Bill, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Listen, it's great to chat with you. As mentioned, I could chat with Gordy all the time, and him being such a humble guy, I thought I'd go right to the source, Mom, because I know that you're very proud of him, and you tell us the truth of how he got it started.
I can't beat around the bush anymore.
And you're so shy, right?
Yeah. Too, Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, you're so shy. I know. Well, Flo, I appreciate this. And when you're talking to Gordy, tell him everybody at the Coast 89.7 is so proud of him. And good luck. Hope he wins the award.
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you.
Provincial NDP leader Claudia Chender came to the regional municipality during a recent road trip that included a few stops up the line. She and her counterparts are preparing for the spring sitting of the legislature. Here's Chender with Bobby Nock from the newsroom, speaking mainly about healthcare and about her ideas for a model that can better connect people with doctors and the concerns about the cost of living.
Well, first of all, welcome to Cape Breton.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
And who do you plan to meet with while you're here? You're here today and tomorrow, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm here through Saturday. So we got here last night, and on the way up, I had some meetings in Antigonish and in Richmond. And today, actually this morning, after you and I speak, we're going to meet with the leadership at the regional hospital, kind of hear a little bit about what's happening with healthcare here. And then we have a whole bunch of meetings with... We have a meeting with the Chamber of Commerce and partnership, but also with the Center for Craft and Design and with other kind of social agencies in town. So really just trying to, you know, essentially my job is to listen and hear, you know, what life is like for folks on the ground. So really looking forward to chatting with folks over the next few days.
Okay, yeah, you've got a busy few days lined up, yeah. And you already made some stops. You were in Antigonish and St. Peter's as well?
That's right. Yeah, so yesterday on the way up, we had a great public session at the Antigonish Library with a great turnout, and we talked, you know, about the same things people right across the province are wanting to talk about, which is, you know, healthcare and the cost of living and the environment. We met with the Antigonish Women's Center and had a chance to sit down and have a chat with the mayor as well. And then, you know, chatted with the warden of Richmond County in St. Peter's, had a great piece of pie, and then got here in time for supper. So it was a full day, but, you know, it's great to be able to hear from people.
Now, you mentioned healthcare, and of course, I guess that's probably the number one issue. Yeah. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, not much has changed over the last year and a half or so. So I think people continue to be extraordinarily concerned about healthcare. I think, you know, we saw the family practice wait list grow again in February. We know that, you know, anywhere in the province, including, you know, in CBRM, something like 10% of folks don't have access to primary care. And, you know, there's ongoing issues from the Strait area to Grace Bay around emergency room closures. We're also, I should say, meeting with the paramedics because we know that that's also been an issue around, you know, access to timely emergency care. So, yeah, these are still the things that people are preoccupied with. Unfortunately, I have yet to hear someone say it's gotten a lot better, but you know, I think we are we're hearing loud and clear from people that they need a solution that's going to make a difference in their lives.
Now, as we know, the Progressive Conservatives made healthcare their number one issue during mm-hmm. their campaign, and they said it's, you know, healthcare isn't going to be fixed overnight, but they have been. It seems almost every week there's an announcement about something. You know, we're taught, you know, there's mobile primary care clinics, clinics mm-hmm. in pharmacies, urgent treatment centers, mm-hmm. expanding virtual mm-hmm. care. The list just seems to go on. So what more could the government be doing?
So I think, as you say, there's lots of announcements. And I think all of those initiatives that you point to are, people really appreciate those. Because if, you know, particularly if you're a senior or like me or a parent of young children, when you need access to care, you need it. And, you know, you're going to take it however you can. But the challenge with all of those is that they're not coordinated care. So if you go to a mobile clinic or you go to virtual care or you go to a pharmacy, they don't keep a record of your visit. If you don't have a family doctor, you know, the next time you need a refill maybe of your prescription, you've got to go back through that whole process again. So I think what people really want and need is access to their own doctor's office. You know, that's what we need. And we're not making a dent in that metric at all. So as you said, like, that list of people without primary care is growing and growing and growing. So it's great to see kind of stopgap efforts, but in the end, what we haven't seen is a real commitment to making sure that people have access to primary care. And we are seeing that in other provinces. So in Prince Edward Island, you know, they have announced that all islanders will have access to what they're calling like a family care home. So, you know, that there will be 14 new clinics opened across the province. They'll be publicly funded, and people will have access either to a doctor or maybe to another allied health professional. That's the model that we think we need here in Nova Scotia. That's heavy lifting. That means really changing our relationship with physicians and other healthcare professionals. But people need consistent access to care. They need a place where their record lives. And they need to know that when they need medical attention, that they can get it, ideally before they have to go to an emergency room.
So it sounds like a model that makes healthcare, I guess, further socializes healthcare, you know, other than the system we have now where you have doctors, you know, working on a fee for service. Are you talking about, you know, making healthcare more of a, you know, expanding the role of government in delivering healthcare, and I guess in its relationship with those who deliver healthcare?
Well, I think our focus is on really on everyday Nova Scotians and making sure that they can go to the doctor. But increasingly, when I talk to physicians, particularly younger physicians, they don't want to be business people. They don't go to medical school to be business people. They go to medical school to be doctors. And so, you know, for years now, there's been discussions and expansion of alternate compensation models for physicians. So I think, you know, yes, you're right in a way. I think what I'm hearing from many physicians is that fee-for-service model, not for everyone, but for many, is actually quite outdated. And I think if we've decided, which I think we at least tacitly have, that it's unlikely that every Nova Scotian is always going to be able to see their own doctor whenever they want to, but that we need to move to a more collaborative model of care, which exists now in certain parts of the province, on the North Shore, the Dalhousie Family Medical Center. You know, we have these examples of collaborative clinics where you make an appointment, and if you need to see a nurse practitioner, you see a nurse practitioner. If you need to see a doctor, but there are other allied health professionals too. So yes, I think it does pull it more into the public system, but I think the challenge is, you know, what we're seeing on the other end of that, which, you know, yesterday it was announced that there's a private nurse practitioner-led healthcare clinic opening in Halifax by subscription. So if you can afford the subscription, you can go to the doctor. If you can't afford it, you can't. We should be wary of that. There's, you know, this government is contracting left, right, and center with private companies around the provision of virtual care. Just yesterday, the announcement of mental health care, that's going to be through TELUS Health. You know, I think we want we want Nova Scotia Health to be the employer of choice for healthcare professionals. I think that we get the best deal for that financially. I think we get the best care for that medically. And I think we have the best chance at actually stemming this healthcare crisis.
Now, this government clinic model, do you have any idea what that would cost? I mean, it's being done in PEI, but of course, Nova Scotia's bigger than PEI and has a bigger population. How any idea what we're talking about here in terms of a cost for such
no,
a thing?
I think we can look to British Columbia, and I think we are crunching those numbers right now, because BC is doing something similar where they've basically offered family doctors an incentive, so an increased kind of compensation package in order to, you know, come into a more collaborative care system. So I don't have the numbers, but, you know, we have the numbers on things like the amount of money we're spending on travel nurses, the amount of money that we're spending on mobile clinics and pharmacists and all of this. And so, you know, I guess what we're saying is let's focus those resources. This is a government who is going to solve the healthcare crisis, and we believe that without a focus on making sure that everyone has consistent access to primary care, that can never happen, because we will always be focused on the acute care level of things. We need to make sure that when you need to go to the doctor, you can go to the doctor. And sadly, 18 months out, we've seen further away from getting there than we did when this government was elected.
Well, and speaking of the travel nurses, I guess comes down to retention as well. I mean, we hear of nurses from Nova Scotia leaving to work as travel nurses because the job is just so stressful here. They say they can't do it.
Well, exactly. But ironically, here is at Nova Scotia Health. So lots of Nova Scotia nurses who leave to work as travel nurses don't actually leave at all. They may actually still work in that very same facility that they were in before, but they get paid twice as much, and they have way more flexibility and a better work environment. So you can't blame those folks for making that lifestyle choice. Our perspective on that is that, as I said, Nova Scotia Health needs to become the employer of choice. They need to respond to the very well-documented concerns of nurses and other healthcare professionals around their work environment. They need to make sure that nurses get a break, that they get an opportunity to eat, that their facilities are properly staffed. It's a vicious cycle because, you know, in many ways, those travel nurses have obviously kept some, you know, facilities and wards up and running when otherwise they couldn't. But for the amount of money we're spending, that money could be much better spent focused on retention of our existing healthcare workforce and even recruiting some of those folks back into the public system. Otherwise, I think both from a healthcare perspective and from a public finance perspective, we are in a lot of trouble with our reliance on public nursing.
I want to ask you a question on healthcare that's very specific to the to Cape Breton, and the Liberals have come out and called on the government to support a PET scanner for the new Cape Breton Cancer Center. Where does the NDP stand on that?
Well, I mean, I think without having thought about that before you asked the question, I would say, you know, we believe that all, regional hospitals should have all of the equipment they need. We were very happy to see last year the announcement of a cath lab, in the new plans for the regional, which I think, you know, is a kind of similar idea that, like, Cape Breton should have access to all of the healthcare infrastructure it needs to serve its population in the same way that the mainland does. And so if a PET scanner is part of that, then by all means, you know, the hospital should be able to have one of those.
Okay. Now, fair enough. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to blindside.
Well, that's okay.
And I did want, before we, Leah, before we finish up, I wanted to, you mentioned the cost of living crisis. What are people telling you on that front? What are you hearing from people?
Oh, gosh. Well, we're hearing huge concerns about, honestly, the cost of groceries and people just being able to afford to eat. And we're hearing huge issues around the cost of housing. And we know here on the island that's as true as anywhere else. It's so difficult to find an affordable place to live. You know, the lists for public housing are miles long and growing by the day as people get priced out of, you know, what was formerly affordable accommodations. And so, you know, we have lots of questions to ask the ministers when we go back into the house about these things. But we also have a lot of proposals that we feel like could make a really appreciable difference immediately. So one of the things we've been calling on is for the government to waive family and seniors' pharmacare fees. We know from research from Feed Nova Scotia that people are regularly choosing between food and medicine. That shouldn't be the case, particularly in the midst of a healthcare crisis. The government could waive those fees and could make life easier for thousands of Nova Scotians and particularly people across Cape Breton Island. We've been calling for investment in truly affordable housing, rent-geared income, non-market housing. I think, you know, here on the island, New Dawn has been a real pioneer in that, and it's been amazing to watch them work, but also to see the hurdles that they have faced in trying to attract some of that funding. This government hasn't built public housing in decades, and it's needed here as much as it's needed anywhere. So, you know, I think there are lots of ways that the government could act. They could implement a affordable, like a low-income energy rate for people. We also have legislation that they could pass that would do that so that people aren't kind of crippled by their power bills and priced out of their accommodations. And we'll continue to push for those things. But, you know, I think what we're hearing about is just a real fear of how people are just going to afford their bills from month to month. And it's a scary time. And the government has the tools to help people ease those fears, and we will continue to push them to use them.
And the government has taken some steps. I mean, I'm thinking of the home heating rebate, the $1,000. I think there was some money for people on social assistance, if I remember correctly. I guess the concern is always that you don't further fuel inflation with some of these measures.
Yeah, although, you know, that's certainly a line that we've heard from the government after, you know, months and months of lobbying. They did introduce that heating assistance rebate program in December, which, you know, I'm really glad you raised that. I think that people still don't know about that program as much as they should, and that can make a real difference for people. So we're very glad to see that. In terms of fueling further inflation, I mean, the reality is if we have to choose between, you know, people living in tents or, you know, how to invest public funds, you know, we always want to make sure that people can afford the basics. I really believe that that's something that the government needs to take responsibility for. And we're, you know, at a moment right now where, you know, just keeping a roof over people's heads is such a precarious situation for so many that, you know, we really support the government taking the steps that it needs to make sure that people can afford to live.
And well, just on that, that's interesting that, you know, if you're wondering about the uptake on that ad rebate, yeah, people may not be aware of it. I think, if I remember correctly, it's for households with income of $83,000 or less. Is that?
85. That's right.
Okay.
And that would be your last year's income. And so, you know, we have heard some concerns, like on the island in particular, with the cost of housing. We have more intergenerational households, which sometimes makes it hard to access that with the threshold if you take, you know, different people's incomes into account. Newcomers are having a hard time accessing those funds because in many cases they won't have filed a tax return in the previous year. So there are still some hurdles that program has that don't allow people to access it. But in general, yeah, we really want people to be aware of that program and to make sure that they take advantage of it if they need it.
Yeah, and people can apply for that online, and I
That's right.
And I think there, I'm trying to remember if there's a 1-800 number as well. I can't remember, but anyway, that there are applications are available online. So
and they could contact their local MLA office. There's lots of ways to access that program.
Right. Well, I appreciate your time with me today, and good luck on your tour here in Cape.
Thanks Barton. So much. Okay, great to chat.
Okay, bye.
Cape Breton Chorale has been around for about 50 years, impressing audiences across the island, the province, and even on the other side of the Atlantic. They are no strangers in rolling out the welcome mat either. Here's Bill Bradley and the Chorale's Melissa McNeil to tell you about a special homecoming and performance that is sure to impress.
It's a brand new year and a brand new year of performances by the Cape Breton Chorale, and one in particular coming up on March 14th. It's a celebration of the Elmer Eisler Singers, conducted by Lydia Adams, and Cape Breton Chorale, conducted by Ryan Billington. And one of the members of the Cape Breton Chorale, Melissa McNeil, is with me here this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This is going to be a big deal coming up on March 14th, and I know that the whole group is excited about this one.
Yeah, we're so excited. It's a real homecoming for Lydia Adams, who some folks might know has a long history in this area and is from Glace Bay, but not everybody may know who they are or who she is. But no matter what your relationship is to the chorale, or if it's your first time seeing a concert like this, it's really going to be a special, special evening.
Tell us a bit about the Elmer Eisler Singers. Am I saying that right?
Yes. So they're based in Ontario, and they would be what you would call a professional chamber ensemble. And all that really means, for folks who may not be aware with that terminology, would be that there's a smaller group. They're a professional choir who they've been in doing tours, workshops, recordings, been nominated for Juno Awards and that sort of thing for quite a number of years in and around the Greater Toronto area and throughout Canada.
Now, this show is coming up on March 14th. It's at 8 o'clock at the Church of Christ the King on Trinity Avenue in Sydney. And tickets are on sale now. How can I get a ticket?
Okay, so there are a few ways. You can go online anytime at capebretonchorale.com. So you can actually get a ticket online right up until the day before. So they'll shut down those online sales the night before the concert. You can contact a member of the chorale if you know one, or you can call 902-270-2591. We may have some tickets available at the door, but we really do recommend that people buy ahead of time.
Really looking forward to this coming up on March 14th. Thanks for this, and keep us updated on what's going on future performances around the island.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.